see.
Yes, they saw. We already got it. Nope, don't do that. Go. Okay, it's recording. All right, good. There you go. All right.
Okay. So I'm going to sit down here. Okay. So good evening. This is December the 8th. Hey, Jay.
Ninth.
And we are starting the December 2023 monthly lecture meeting of National Capital Astronomers. I think we're going to have a very interesting talk. I'm looking forward to it very much. Let's see. Who here? So our meetings are always free and open to the public, and we welcome new members. And the dues for adults are currently $10, rising to in June to $15. Okay. Who here is a current member paid up, and you know that for a fact? Okay. So anybody here used to be a member, but isn't anymore? Okay. Those of you who are not.
Yes, I think this is the last year. I now have to pay up.
Okay. I've got on my briefcase over there, I've got membership forms. And right there under my hat over there. Okay. And for a student, it's only $5. Those of you online, if you would like to join, normally you can just go to our website, which is capitalastronomers.org. Unfortunately, it's down, and Elizabeth is fighting with the host company. And hopefully we'll get it fixed soon. Hope so. Is there anybody here who did not receive a copy of this month's newsletter? Did not get it? Good, you all got it. But those online, I can't see your hands up. If you did not get it, put a note in the chat, please, and let us know, and we'll try to, straighten that out. Okay. Just a little summary about the Exploring the Sky public observing events. Our last one for the year I thought was a great success, and so did the park rangers. We had over 200 people. It's been increasing steadily every month this year, which is really nice coming out of the pandemic. Many thanks to Renee Ra Ranger Renee Mayer or
Mayor.
Mar Mayer, is it?
Mar.
For coming up with the idea of having the planetarium show right before the event. And many, many thanks to Jay Miller for hosting and heading all those events for so many years. Please give him a round of applause. He's really done a great job. Thank you very much. And if you haven't helped out at one of those things, it's a really great positive feeling when a kid or an adult is seeing the moon or the planets for the first time. They say, "Oh, wow." It's nice, and it'll be even better next year. We need more folks running telescopes at that event. It's only one evening a month, just for a few hours, and it's great fun. We need a new Washington meetup organizer. Jay had talked about taking that over, but have you finished details on that?
On which?
Taking over the Washington meetup
Oh,
thing?
the
Yeah.
meetup? Yeah, I mean, I can take care of that. Unfortunately, it's not free. It costs money.
No, it's not. It costs a ridiculous amount of money, in my
Yeah,
opinion.
it's about 150 something like that a year.
What is it? Without
Washington
this,
meetup is.
it's a general people get together. It's a way for people to get together to do various things in the metropolitan area, whether it's going for a hike or a walk or going to an astronomy meeting or just something like that. And somebody had been putting NCA's Exploring the Sky on there, and he's not going to be doing it this coming year.
So you need someone to take over and put it in.
Yeah, and it
Yeah.
costs money. I mean, I can do it, but somebody's got to pay for it, either NCA or me or somebody else.
And additional ways of notifying the public about such events would be good. And we also need more people interested in taking out the NCA SolarMax scope out in the daytime so they can see all kinds of details on the sun. It's pretty amazing. And we need a new vice president to find speakers and candidates for office for the next year. And thank you very much for John Hornstein for doing that for all these years. We talked in the board, that is to say the elected officers and trustees and some other folks, about possible bulk purchase of solar glasses. This is the design that my daughter, Alexandra Brandenburg, came up with. And it's, I think it's really nice looking, and it'll be safe. And we have an eclipse coming up April 8th. Some of us are going there. By the way, who here is going to Totality? Okay, how many people don't know if they're going? Okay. Anybody not going?
I am tasked with running a program here at campus for the department. I will be asking for volunteers. It would be great if we had a few NCAAers to help out with it.
Okay.
Well, I probably would be down at Air and Space.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. But I figure there's enough NCA members that we can, between the two, we can easily do it.
Okay.
Guy, just how many of these glasses do you intend to buy or thinking of buying?
Well, that's the thing. I don't know. I was trying to get some suggestions.
The cheaper they are.
Yeah. Well, I mean, are we talking about 500, 1,000?
Yeah.
Maybe a couple hundred, 500, or 1,000. Those are sort of the ballpark.
1,000, that's about 45 cents each.
Yeah.
Okay. Which is doable. I mean, the club has money. It's not, it's still like $45.
I think it's like more like a dollar each.
Well, it depends on what company you get it from. But Rainbow Symphony, you can buy some for 45 cents a piece for 1,000 pair.
Yeah. Yeah.
With personalization or without?
I don't know about the personalization. I don't really know why. Sure, if you want personalization, it's probably going to cost you more.
Yeah, that would cost you.
I don't know why we need to get the personalization. They do have their nice solar eclipse glass, which is what we had some here at one of the meetings. They look nice, and their ISO and all have that well-rated, good glasses, $1,045 each, $450, it's fine.
Yeah, I think plugging the club would be a good thing too. But in any case, we have not come to a discussion.
Going back to the full eclipse, where do we get information about the best way to go?
Best way to go?
Where to stay, et cetera, like?
Well, there are lots
of... It's all sold out. No matter where you want to go, it's all sold out.
Well, you don't really need to get a room to stay in the zone of totality. There are many, many resources which will tell you exactly where the zone will be. It's not very wide, but this is a big country and there's lots of motels all over it. And you can easily drive, 50, 60 miles or 100 miles in a morning to get to the location. So if you want to have your motel right in the zone of totality, I'm sure, those are all sold out, but you don't have to be there. You don't have to stay there. So we have not organized a club outing to there. I know that Northern Virginia Astronomy Club, which is one of the largest clubs in the country, they have done a lecture and advice on how to take photographs of it, but even they have not organized a group, hotel or anything like that. There are a whole bunch of sky events coming up. One is, the one on the left is our Sky Watchers. That's in the Stardust. Betelgeuse or Betelgeuse or Ibdaljauza is going to be occulted on Monday, not visible from here. And that's an enormous star. And if an asteroid goes in front of it, we can perhaps tell quite a bit about the atmosphere of Betelgeuse. Yes.
So the occultation, while not visible from our area, the guy in Italy, virtual telescope guy, he is going to be live broadcasting it because it's visible from his area. And I believe someone sent a note to the mailing list about that.
Two Bassett sent it.
Right. So yeah. There's a link to a live view of it.
Thank you.
Pay attention to the time because it's not going to be in the evening.
I thought it was 8 o'clock at night.
Is it? Well, whatever time it is for them. So just pay attention to the time.
Yeah.
So he is broadcasting from Italy.
Okay. And tomorrow's the NOVAC public meeting, and they're going to be talking about the Vera Rubin Observatory, which is not yet built. And Vera Rubin, of course, was a member of NCA for quite some time when she was younger. If you like, NOVAC has always a number of interesting events in different places. And on this issue, I wrote a long article for Stardust about why travel to any exoplanet is only possible if you believe in science fiction as opposed to the laws of physics. Because a one-way trip to any exoplanet in a habitable zone, even if you could get up to 1% of the speed of light, which is 15 times faster than any spacecraft we've launched so far, would take centuries or millennia. And then if you look at the timeline of life on our planet, if you look at the fine detail here, most of the life you see there is just single cells, or maybe, mats of algae and stuff. The plants and flowers and reptiles and mammals are only a little tiny part. So if we actually did find, after 6,000 years of travel, which is longer than civilization has existed, you would probably find a place that all they have is bacteria.
Which would not be fun. You just have to vote for Republicans, and then they will repeal the laws of physics.
Okay. All right. So, yeah, what I want people to look through the telescope.
They won't bother repealing them. They'll just ignore them.
Yes.
I want them to realize how lucky we are to live on this nice, wonderful planet.
Yeah.
And everything you are seeing in the telescope, everything is a version of hell. And we better not turn this one into hell. Okay, so we should thank our lucky stars. Any other announcements? Okay. Our speaker actually is going to be talking about something quite interesting, about the great debate on the on a number of things. I'll let her talk about it. And well, first,
I'm going to let John introduce her.
Yes.
And while John's introducing her, I'm going to switch things over.
Okay. John, go ahead.
Okay. During the 1920s, astronomers faced two related puzzles. Nearby fuzzy objects were clearly composed of excited gas and dust, and they were called nebula. But what were the many fuzzy objects that were more distant, whose structure was impossible to discern with the telescopes available at the time? A related question was whether the Milky Way was the entire universe, or whether there were objects outside of the Milky Way. According to Wikipedia, Harlow Shapley was the most famous US astronomer of that era. So Harlow Shapley was a very important participant in attempts to answer those questions. Besides being an observational astronomer at Mount Wilson and at the Harvard Observatory, Shapley actively worked for human rights and peace. He played a role in the formation of the National Science Foundation. He was a president of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, and he fought against pseudoscience. He was also an innovative thinker. For example, he argued that life existed around at least some other stars because there were so many other stars, and that at least a fraction of them would have a region around them in which planets could have liquid water. In this, he was far ahead of his time, because the possibility of exolife now drives many of our present major space missions and even a lot of our ground-based observational astronomy. Harlow Shapley's wife, Martha Betts Shapley, was also an astronomer, and she was a significant astronomer and has her own Wikipedia page. And her daughter, Mildred Shapley Matthews, was also a noted astronomer. One of her two sons became an administrator at NASA, and another son became a prize-winning mathematician. Altogether, it was an utterly remarkable family. Deborah has developed a useful... Deborah Shapley, our speaker this evening, was a granddaughter of Harlow and Martha Shapley. Deborah has developed a useful website, the Harlow Shapley Project. Its URL is given in the latest issue of Stardust, but it can also be accessed by using Harlow Shapley Project as a search term in any search engine. This evening, Deborah Shapley will provide insights into her remarkable grandparents and their contributions to our hard-won understanding of the universe. But before that, I'd like to make two points. First, although the term debate arises in this discussion, remember that this was a debate within science where a definitive answer was possible. You have to first figure out or stumble upon the right observational question to ask, and then you have to be ingenious and hardworking enough to obtain the relevant data. But unlike in non-science, there was a definitive answer almost certainly exists. Second, there is currently a close analog of the question that astronomers were seeking to answer back then. You may have heard the term the multiverse. This refers to the possibility that our universe is not the only one, but just one among many. If there were others, it might be possible to explain our Big Bang as the result of a rare interaction between universes. Can you think of the hard part is, can you think of data that might show whether or not our universe is the only one? And if there are others, could we ever learn about what their others are like? And even if there were a multiverse, we would still face the question of how the multiverse started. Deborah, looking forward to your talk.
Thank you.
Thank you, everybody. Where is Elizabeth gone?
Your slide is up.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Can you see me?
Yes.
I can see John. Hi, John. You're up in the...
The others are there. You can't see them.
Okay, great.
All we see is the slide. That's all we need to see.
Okay, perfect. Good evening, everybody. Thank you very much for having me. It's a tremendous honor to be here. Milt was just showing me that Harlow Shapley spoke here in 1959 to an audience of 400, but that was maybe in the springtime, I guess, and had a little more going for him. Due to interruptions, including that of my printer, some of these slides have blanks, and the images are not actually present, although they're available. So I'm going to resubmit with the complete pictures, but most of them are here. And I'll just talk my way slowly, so when you make the recording, we know what I'm talking about. I'm very indebted to this BBC production by a very good astronomy writer who put this together in May of 2021. And this is the BBC's rendition of a Harlow Shapley portrait and Heber Curtis and a lovely graphic. So I borrowed it with credit. This is the Baird Auditorium where the debate took place. And my title is Who Really Won? Or subtitle, What to Do When You've Lost? And because of the educated audience, I'm going to assume that you know quite a lot about the island universe versus big galaxy debate and what it was. I see some nods, and I decided, made a strategic decision to not rehash an extensive literature, which I did read a great deal of. I have, in particular, this book with me to show, which is my, as you can see, my best go-to reference about all of this.
What's the title of
this? Oh, excuse me, you can't see it. It's The Expanding Universe, Astronomy's Great Debate, 1900 to 1931. The dates are significant for my talk, which will extend past that time. It's by Michael Hoskin, Robert Smith, a British. And I also am very indebted to the work of Nemiroff and Jerry Bonnell, who organized the Diamond Jubilee of the debate in 1995. My father was present. So the debate has come down in history. The original one was in 1920 at the Baird Auditorium, as we know. And then there was a Diamond Jubilee in 1995, organized around another, and then 96, 98, 2020. And it's also taught extensively, or has been taught extensively. And my talk tonight, since I'm more of a science policy writer and historian, is perhaps to take issue with teaching the great debate as a one-on-one duke it out slugger zero sum. I have a younger. And I asked him to go look at some things that embodied the situation as it's generally imagined. And I like that the title of this graphic is Godzilla Kaiju versus other Kaiju. The big question is who will win? And here's a milder but charming one, which is actually a comic strip. And there's simply no question that using that the motif of using a contrary positions and requiring people that hold contrary, scientists that hold contrary positions to debate in front of their peers, which is what the great debate was, is an extraordinarily useful thing to be able to do, and that it should be taught. And of course, this particular historic episode is so well documented that it should continue to be mined for its teaching value. My concern is, what does it teach? Let's just dive into the story quickly. Here's one little bit of a blank on the side. Here is actually the telegram from George Ellery Hale to his staffer, Harlow Shapley, dated February 18th, 1920. I pulled it from a box the other day at home and scanned it for you. And it is his suggestion. Academy proposes debate between you and Heber Curtis, subject scale of universe, at Washington meeting April 26th or 27th, 5 minutes each. Honorarium for each speaker, $150. hope you will wire acceptance to Abbott, Smithsonian Institution, and inform me. George Ellery Hale ran the Mount Wilson Observatory, and I think he was the president of the National Research Council at the time, and hope you will wire acceptance. Sounds like an instruction. Shapley was very nervous about this. He accepted, of course. And the rest is history. I was going to try to tally the scores that have been done by experts through the years, including this guy, but there are many of them.
Scorecards.
And the charts are so dense and the issues so confusing that what you are going to see in the final slide is a montage of scorecards by other people. because far be it from me. But the general story is well known that those in the auditorium thought that Eber Curtis, the senior experienced astronomer, had done a much better job, and he had defended the island universe idea proposal and had been quite direct about it. And he was from Lick Observatory, and the Lick group believed in that, and Hubble was part of the Lick group in their way that they approached the problem. It's also well known that Harlow Shapley was very nervous and young and had not done a lot of public speaking. And apparently his notes when they were uncovered years later show that they are just were just a total mess. And why did he take half of the talk to get to the most elementary matters of astronomy? He was in front of the National Academy of Sciences. Why was he doing this? And then why at the end did he talk about some light gathering gadget he had invented? And the answer is that he knew that two gentlemen from Harvard were in the audience whose goodwill he wanted to become the director of Harvard. Pickering had just died. So the general story is that Shapley's personal performance was poor, and he said it was a, quote, draw, but he was hard on himself. So that's the point. He sort of felt he lost it. Contrary to what is written, again, a little blank here, the debate did get some actual press. And this is an example. And I, as a newsman, that's part of what I bring to this project. And I love this cartoon, which I also cut out and put on my folder. Some poor little astronomer, and then the universes are flying around saying to each other, ha ha, we've got him guessing. It's charming. And it ran in the Okaloosa, Kansas Journal on June 11th, 2020. And how did the Okaloosa, Kansas Journal know about the great debate? Well, first of all, Harlow Shapley had worked as a reporter for several papers out in Missouri and Kansas. And if you read the actual text of this, you will note a certain classic eloquence and a certain, Curtis defended the old theory against the new ideas kind of thing. So Owen Gingrich, who knew Shapley well and knew our family, we had a lot of laughs about Harlow Shapley ghosting articles and sending them by wire that then were run because the copy was so good, they just sent it downstairs to the press room. And Owen said to me, you know, those telegraph wires must have been burning, you know. However, what I want to point out is that the zero sum, really, the rest of this talk has got the pictures. This was the easier part, so I didn't load them right away. In fact, he had many reasons to believe that the spiral nebulae were not within his galactic model and were not even part of the galaxy structurally. So it's a slight mischaracterization to say that he said they were locked in there. He already knew, for example, so his positions are not the way that they are portrayed. A big galaxy holds everything, including the other universes, the possible universes. he had already found one in 1917 and reported it in the Andromeda Nebula and reported it as a million light years away. And there were several and other reasons. So you find that actually the position was not as hard and fast as that. So my touchstone quote is this. This is the alternative to the Battle of Titans, either or. And I'll read it for the benefit of those listening. Nemiroff, who did this wonderful project to reenact the revive the 1995 debate, writes, "The debate is an example of how two very successful scientists interpreted observations and data and tried to synthesize a coherent overall picture. Each suspected that some of their data available was wrong or misleading. Each was forced to choose without the benefit of hindsight." And that, I think, is a very insightful statement about the real way in which scientists interact with each other constructively. You can call it debate or whatever. There they are talking to each other. I guess that's Shapley. And besides, he won. After ghosting articles, being persuading various people, spirit seniors, Dr. Shapley was asked to come up to East Harvard, actually in a subordinate position, but with the expectation, which he certainly had, that he would be given the vacant real directorship. And again, many of the narratives end at this point that he had been grasping for the big job. He gave a non-scientific talk at the big debate, and then he did all these ambitious things, left the East, moved to Cambridge, and then somehow, by hook or crook, by November 1st, 1921, was appointed permanent director. And again, from my files, I scanned for you today the certificate, which is really a sort of parchment-y thing, from the Harvard Corporation, dated October 31st, and appointing him director November 1st. That's one day before his 36th birthday. And I love this interesting 1920s photo, which Mount Wilson has now made it into a poster, the longer one, which you saw in your newsletter, because he's looking at you and he's daring. And if you see the whole pose, the jacket is open. It's like, here I am, you know, whoops. So really the blanks are going to fill in. One thing that he did as he took over was to continue writing articles. And he was able to, he dictated in Greg's shorthand or to a dictaphone. There's a photo of him at the dictaphone. The famous desk is next to him. And the wax cylinder would reel and the secretary would type and the telegrams would be sent off. And the productivity of this man was extraordinary. And you may know that Harvard already was the Bureau of Telegrams for observations from observatories all over the U.S. And then it was like today's Instagram or internet or email. The practice was to immediately redistribute those announcements so that other observatories could train their telescopes quickly on something that was reported in another location. And that was the Astronomical Telegraph Service run at Harvard Observatory. Well, Shapley added to that bulletins and also regular news dispatches. And Science Service, you may know, started in the same time and began as a news service. And Shapley and the news service got rolling. And finally, I want to just to point out that his manner of public speaking improved dramatically in those first years. Guy is smiling because he knows what I'm talking about. And not for nothing did 400 people come to hear him in 1949. However, he lost. And the story usually ends here when he opens a letter from Hubble. You know, it's like a costume drama. He opens the letter and Hubble has now told Shapley, his rival, that Hubble is now at Mount Wilson. He's been studying these cepheids. He's been making measurements. He's using Shapley's system. But he doesn't particularly credit Shapley, but he has to stay in touch with Shapley. And so they have to keep going back and forth. And, oh, I've got it now. I've confirmed. And that is the end of the, that's the end of the drama, that Shapley lost the debate. He oiled his way into the job at Harvard, got it at the last minute anyway, and now he's lost on this island in universes because they're real and his galaxy model was wrong, or his claims were wrong. So he's a loser. So my point tonight is that when you lose, you can turn around and accept the evidence and make good with it. And Shapley made the study of galaxies a focus of his and Harvard Observatory's research for decades. You can ask yourself if the subsequent 30 years I'm about to mention, explain, and add to the story would have happened if there hadn't been these setbacks. He was not humble. And here's a famous quote, which I'll read. Charles Whitney is quite a reliable source. He was a grad student, and he says a lot of very sensible things in his commentaries on the period. I have never seen a quicker mind, a more agile sense of humor, nor a more complete absence of what usually passes for humility. Marsha Barczewiak has actually got me going on this theme, and that's one reason I'm giving you this talk tonight. She writes, Shapley, in response to the growing body of evidence, at last saw the scientific handwriting on the wall. He cried uncle, acquiescing speedily and graciously. Once proven wrong, the Harvard Observatory director didn't look back and quickly adjusted to the new cosmic landscape, becoming its most boisterous promoter. A good scientist, yes.
Yes.
Yes. Seeing.
Yeah.
But what I hope you've taken from my earlier remarks was that this literature has plenty of evidence that he could see the possibilities that the other side was right. I mean, that there was some other explanation for these nebulae that was not being accounted for, and they were not structurally, maybe they were flowing through and so forth. There were many theories about it. Again, that is oversimplified. So I just wanted to make sure that with fixing up, we credit him with having in the Depression building D at Harvard, which maybe some of you have been to, which is a Georgian thing, and it's very well used. And there is Granady dedicating it in September of 32 with some big shots, and it's very visibly, the larger photo is the stairs. And the point of it was to make room for the computers, the ladies who worked, and to expand the staff, and also to have a vaulted space, which you can still go to, which you descend, and it's fireproof, meant to be fireproof. So he was arranging for the expansion of this data collection, which of course was not just galaxies. There was the Henry Draper catalog, which was the Henry Draper Memorial, excuse me. And most of the people in this audience can say the right names of the studies, but the point being, there was the opportunity to enlarge the collection and interpretation, and from both hemispheres, which the California people couldn't do. So we needed to know about the distribution of stars and galaxies, how uniform, what's going on out there. And Harvard had data going back to the 1880s. Shapley had moved the station to South Africa and gotten some more telescopes and stuff. So what happens next? Adelaide Ames had a job, I think, at the Springfield Armory. I'm not sure, but she had gotten her degree, was getting her degree, and interviewed for a job and was hired right away by Shapley. She was his first graduate student in 1923. And it's very, very interesting that he gave her immediate responsibility in terms of interpreting the plates for galaxy shapes and distribution. He was immediately turning on to this question of that Harvard's plates should be able to show the distribution of different types. And Adelaide Ames was obviously quite an exceptional scientist herself. And she's very well remembered by the other ladies and the other participants. And at that time, she also was given responsibility. And so in terms of the story of the women at Harvard in the Shapley era, it's important that for an example is that I'm going to list them in the box, but for example, she was given the responsibility of managing the IAU conference, which was to take place at Harvard at the time of an eclipse in September of 1932. But meanwhile, she and Shapley are analyzing galaxies specifically, and they've decided to use Hubble's classification, which is better than the one Shapley had come up with. So that's an example of integration between the two. So we have Coma and Virgo, and I'm grateful to Jeff Canipe, my colleague in Colorado, who labeled these an hour ago in time for you to see them. These are very, very famous maps from the catalog that Shapley and Ames compiled from between 1930 and 32. It's published in the Harvard Annals, page after page of 1249 galaxies. Every feature of them, including their shape and types in the Hubble system. And they find that they're not uniformly distributed. And this is the more striking because the southern hemisphere is on the right, as you can see, and the northern hemisphere is on the left. And then in the next one, thanks again to Jeff for having stuck on the arrows. So again, in the equatorial view, you see how uneven they are. Mildred was at breakfast. They all had breakfast at the same meals at the same time. One morning, my father unscrolled a scroll 1 yard long and 2 feet wide as we moved at the breakfast table. He said, "Notice these groupings." "Clusters of galaxies?" she asked. Carlos says, "Yes, this spottiness is interesting, isn't it? Now what are you going to do?" I wanted to know. "Go deeper. Begin looking and cataloging the fainter than 13th magnitude galaxies. We must study these groupings. It appears that galaxies gravitate and move in groups." So there was the capability, both with the new telescopes and the archives of data, to look at the fainter ones. The famous catalog is out to the 13th. And he had already begun the 18th. Again, it relates to the great debate, because why was he doing this? And this Owen Gingrich and others have noticed, and it just cannot be missed, that the unevenness of distribution is very, very striking. The black in this view at the upper left are the patches that had been actually studied enough to be included in the catalog. The catalog was actually never finished. But what he's reporting in 1931, April of 1931, is how much they have now gathered going out this morning. So there's a new fight with Hubble. Not a fight, a debate. Hubble, as is well known, did not want, as he had plunged farther out and the Einstein's ideas were changing the way they all looked at the shape of the universe. Something has come on the screen.
My occultation watcher.
She hit a button called close it. So there's a debate between Shapley and others, different schools of thoughts about whether the universe is uniform and what is all the matter. And it's well known that Hubble really didn't want there to be anything else other than the objects that he was specializing in. It would confuse everything. I don't know exactly what the reasons were. And he also, as everybody knows, had a real reluctance to go beyond the thing that he did so brilliantly. So here is Harlow writing to Hubble. Again, their correspondence is extensive. You may think that I emphasize irregularity too much, but there is a deep meaning in non-uniformity in star distribution. These irregularities in distribution of nebulae are highly important structural phenomena. And I have the facts to put in here, but a very fascinating aspect that has not really been explored, and is some scholars have got to get busy on this, is that Lemaître was actually in Cambridge to get his PhD from MIT in this period of the 20s. The PhD was awarded, I've got the dates in my notes, I'm going to fill it in there. And however, Marcia Bartusiak explains, and it's clear, that actually the place in Cambridge that he found most people to talk to was up at the Harvard Observatory. And of course, the Shapleys welcomed people, and there were many guests. So this Belgian priest is walking around talking French and laughing and going into the workroom and looking at the galaxy maps while he's actually, you know, playing bridge. We've got stories about that and other things that he did. Delightful guy, apparently. Correcting Einstein as well. That was a little bit part of his, how he became into the news at that time. So his paper about that was later referred to as the primeval atom is actually published in, I think, 27, back in Belgium in an obscure journal. But he had been visiting Harvard in 1925, 26, when Shapley and Ames are figuring out about all these clusters. So he wanted to know, Lemaître, why is the universe coming apart, that expanding in this uneven way? I mean, is this wonderful or what? Marcia Bartusiak said, I would love to be a fly on the wall in those conversations. So now quickly to the modern era. Again, Shapley loses, or the West Coast, I hate talking this way, but that's how it's told, that the bitterness between some of the West Coast people and Shapley's maybe overblown sense of whatever. Anyway, whatever, there's been a split in East and West Coast astronomy. It's not for me to say more about that, but it was one of the first things that anybody at Harvard ever told me when I started the project. And we know that Caltech and the other institutions began flourishing, of course, also because of space and rocketry. this will have the photos of these people who took up the survey activity out on the West Coast, because new technology enabled other instrumentation, and the glass plates, the ability of Harvard telescopes was quite limited, and the field was changing with technology. Zwicky, you know, is famous for the discovery of dark matter. And again, they were making surveys of their own, and the field moves ahead. Vera Rubin, this is a testimony to how precise that cataloging was. As Vera analyzed the Harvard galaxy counts, she noticed something odd with the magnitude of the faintest galaxies in the catalog. In her 1954 PNAS paper, based on her doctoral research, she noted that the scales were off by a tenth of a magnitude. We don't yet know which pieces, but Ashley Yeagers was very helpful looking this up for me. This discrepancy led her to develop a calculation by which she could correct each listed magnitude. She wrote to Shapley to see if he could help her figure out the problem, and they corresponded. Perhaps these contacts helped her develop a calculation by which she could correct each listed magnitude, which she shows in the paper. In other words, the brightness wasn't corresponding to the mass that was somewhere there in them galaxies. And Vera found these little teensy things in the early 50s in documentation compiled with the old technology in the 30s and said, there's something funny here. The catalog continued to be used out there on the West Coast. And these, we could have a better list, but these were the leading ones that I found of the later surveys. And Edwin Hubble, whose tirades about other people, including Shapley, were famous to those who had to listen to them, was apparently saying about him, and then pointed to his own penciled up copy of the Shapley Ames catalog and said, on the other hand, this is the best thing that Shapley ever did. So just to finish about the filaments and voids and the things they saw in the maps, I just grabbed, I'm not sure which images are the best, but we can come back to Harvard and the CFA redshift survey and wall, and that identified these filaments and voids, and that looks like it has some relationship to what was just being discovered at a very crude level years before. So the discovery of the Great Wall, it owes something back to this ancestry. And this, I just grabbed this about the Coma Cluster. This is from the Sloan Survey. And again, the Shapley Ames project brought out the density. And then, of course, I couldn't resist sharing anything that's named for him still. And this is the Shapley Supercluster, which might have been named so in his time. This, the attractor was named for him by someone else, whoops, later. And it's important that he does get some credit out there in space. So I'm quoting for you again his letter to Hubble. There is a deep meaning in non-uniformity in star distribution. These irregularities in distribution of nebulae are highly important structural phenomena. And he's writing that to Hubble in July of 1932. And you know, the interest or even obsession with the going farther and farther out, taking more and more measurements, hiring more people to keep going through these plates and recording and then publishing the more and more pieces of the puzzle farther out. What he's looking for late in his career is the edge. And if you read his quotes, he's looking for the density gradient, because is it open or closed? And he thinks the distribution is going to give him the answer to it stops. So he's still, here he is, another one, figure 2075. And I brought with me an earlier copy to make the point. And this is why I brought these few books for you. My friends know I'm always getting books up and waving them around at people. This is the, I guess you can't see me, I'll hold it up by my face. This is actually Harlow Shapley's copy of the second Harvard astronomy book on galaxies. And I think this one is 1961. The first one was in the 40s. He invented the series of Harvard books on astronomy that were meant for the layman and for the college student, beautifully written. And there's series about each. Cecilia wrote one, Bart Bockwalt wrote one on different. And I'm here on the slide is the third edition, published posthumously in 1973. And Paul Hodge contributed to this one. And I have two copies of that one, actually. So he's still in the game. He's still really, really fascinated by the issue of galaxy distribution. So finally, thank you for patiently hearing and looking interested. What are these scientific debates for? And how can we teach the great debate better? And finally, who really won? My closing quote is from Neil deGrasse Tyson, who made a commentary in 1995 at the time of the 75th anniversary. And I'll read it. Today, what we need are more of these debates. This would allow the community of scientists to share with the public the turbulent paths that lead to scientific discovery, paths that reveal science not at its worst, but at its best. So thank you very much for listening.
This is certainly a great talk.
Well, thank you.
I think they both won. Shapley got the job.
Yeah.
Curtis was sort of right. I mean, they both were right. And they both got what they needed at the moment.
Okay. I have a hand up here. Hi.
Yeah. I was an undergraduate at the University of Pittsburgh in the late 50s.
Can everybody hear?
Yeah.
And I remember being in the student union and I was an undergraduate student at the University of Pittsburgh in the late 50s. And I remember being in the student union, and I think I was sitting on the floor and Harlow Shapley was giving a talk. I mean, it's so long ago, I have absolutely no recall of what he was talking about, but I know that I heard him give a talk in the late 50s.
Yay! Yes.
I heard him give a talk in Burlington, Vermont in the early 60s. I was in high school and I had read an article about this long on Cepheid variables, and I stood up and offered a theory on what made them work. And I don't remember my theory, but I remember he was polite.
Yeah, hi.
Vera Rubin was a member of the National Capital.
We had someone speaking in the audience.
Okay. Here.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I find it quite interesting, more related to the presentation. how what the focus of the debate is. When you think about debate, you're mostly thinking of how you are defending your own position as a personal opinion, right? But obviously that's not a scientific debate, right? Scientific debates are different, and that distinction needs to be made, relating back to the question of how you teach the debate better, is to first make it clear that the goal of the debate, what the goal is to seek answers. And that is the ultimate goal, is to get that ultimate answer. I find it quite interesting. It really is quite fascinating.
So you're advocating that when the debate is set up and the participants and the topic worded.
Yeah, sort of.
That then which answers are falling in the bucket of the project?
Yeah, as it was said in the beginning, right, this scientific debate, there's only one answer, and it's a definitive answer, right? And it needs to be said the goal of the debate, what the goal is. And yeah, it really is quite fascinating because it's not like a typical debate, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I find it hard to quite yet grasp how, although I don't teach myself, but I'm not a teacher, but so many sources are to prove this. How you then structure it, maybe teams or sequences or Russian dolls that unfold from each other or something like
that. Yeah, it can get quite difficult to teach. I would assume that one way to do it is to just branch it off and teach one individually, and then later you can connect those. Because once you know how each branch works, then you know how they connect, more or less, depending on what the topic really is.
So you can have two scores. You can have a score for possibly reaching an objective, fact-based answer, if one is possible, for the most likely one. And then you could have another score for the best pathway to deal with the unknowns or something like that, so that you reward the ingenuity of the moment or many moments. Yes, sir.
I understand that both of the people, that is to say Curtis and Shapley, presented their thoughts revised and extended, like, you know, congressional speakers do. And they were quite different.
Yes.
From the original presentation. I've not read any of it.
Yes, that's exactly right, Guy. I just think that we also, can you make that on the screen?
I'm trying to. I don't know why it's not showing up now.
I just think it's more useful. They already know about the demo. Look at you. Thank you. Yes, apparently they had agreed not to trade positions ahead of time, which was really very interesting because, as I was saying, in the era, scientists corresponded by letter, and then the letter took the train across the country. So one guy on the West writes and it takes a day, and then he might, it's wonderful for historians. But Curtis and Shapley apparently agreed not to plan it out ahead beyond the immediate limits. And there's a story in here or someplace that they were on the same train that went through Alabama to come up to Washington, and they chatted about everything else and had to stand around on the train platform to quietly not give it. So what happened in the room. And it's, some commentator said, it will always be something of a mystery. But it was agreed immediately by all concerned that they would have real presentations. They would take what they had said and make it for publication. And then they exchanged those manuscripts
of which Shapley had a manuscript and Curtis had a manuscript, and then the history of that. So in May of 21, the National Research Council published in one volume the pair. And part of the drama of this thing is that that was believed to be what they the real record, and that was used in reenactments in various ways through the time as the years went on. And then in 1975 or 76, a historian named Michael Hoskin found Shapley's actual notes and discovered that, or maybe found a transcript. And what he said was this sort of funny, disorganized, strange thing. And Curtis was okay, but at least Curtis was better organized, but then he had been a professor for many years. So it was revealed. I mean, this is another Shapley loses again story. And Hoskins' write-up of this is really kind of... He found, you know, the emperor has no clothes when he's trying to give his first important speech when he's 35 years old. Yeah, sir.
I got the impression that Shapley was like 29 or so in his 20s.
He was 34, I think.
34. Oh, yeah. Okay. All right.
Yeah.
I believe John Hornstein had a question.
Oh, yeah, John.
Yeah, yeah. Actually, it's a fact. Vera Rubin joined the National Capital Astronomers when she was 16 years old, and she was still attending meetings until shortly before she died.
Isn't that great? Isn't that great? Yeah, I met her a few times. Yeah. Sir.
Another
question. Was Missy Grace Roman.
Yeah.
The more I read about Shapley in the last few days and what he did outside of science, it made me more and more appreciative of him as a person. Now, the vanity part, the humility part, I didn't hear about that, but the fact that he hires people like Ms. Ames and Cecilia Payne Kaposhkin, and was said to have managed to spirit out of Europe in the days of the Nazi menace a number of Jewish scientists who would not have otherwise survived. That was quite impressive. And then he stood up to the House Un-American Activities Committee. Well, you know, certainly no communist or atheist or anything like that. He was simply on the right side of just about every issue of the day.
Well, thank you, Guy. I'm so glad you caught up with that. If you go onto my web, harlowshapley.org, and look down to the post Shapley's Legacies After Mount Wilson, which was my talk last summer at Mount Wilson. The middle part of that talk is about the effort to save people who were at risk. And the ins and outs of that were really complicated. But there's no question that many of the attempts succeeded. And one, when I'm at Harvard 2 weeks from now, I'm going to actually be in those folders because I think a good thing for the project would be to find the descendants of those people. But it you said he was on the right side, but you have to understand that by today's standards or later liberal standards, standing up to the House American Activities Committee or, well, okay, after he appeared before that subcommittee, the subcommittee chairman came out and told the press that Dr. Shapley was the rudest I have never seen a witness treat this committee with more contempt. Chapley standing next to him, he's ready with his statement saying, Star Chamber Gestapo tactics. And the press early. And Chapley's lawyer has been kicked out the room, and the lawyer is standing there saying, oh, God, no, what is. And meanwhile, he's in time for press deadline, and the reporters are running to the phones to file for that afternoon's edition. And then how do you know MacArthur gives a speech and says that Harlow Shapley is one of the known communists in the State Department, and he was never in the State Department. So the reporters call him up, and he says, Senator MacArthur has told 6 lies in 4 sentences, which is a record for outdoor mendacity. That gets out here. But you know, it cost him with the Harvard Corporation and the people who wanted to get him. I mean, there were, you get enemies if you're that sassy. It's hard for people to understand the nuances of the time. Yeah, hi. I saw your
hand. Hi. I'd like to make a comment on what the gentleman was saying. I have a problem with American rhetorical debates in general. I think we're on the wrong track. Both publicly, what you see on television and radio, and in science, I think it's much more useful. For example, if you have to figure something out for yourself, you have to keep both sides of the question open in your mind until you can determine everything that's there. And there are too many unknowns and too many gray areas with overlaps. Mm-hmm. So it's misleading to make a judgment too soon.
Mm-hmm. So what would you do instead? Have a panel?
I think we have to be more honest mm-hmm. and say the IPCC is actually pretty good about this by having different categories of reliability of estimates.
Mm-hmm. The IPCC.
Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change.
That's what I've heard you say.
They're on the right track there. I think we, instead of having debates, we need to have more scientific, open explorations, discussions that are exploratory rather than argumentative in general. Then we have a second problem. It's more specific. And in science, if you have theories with the hypotheses and you try to when you try to prove the hypothesis, let's take the Hubble constant. As I understand it, right now there are at least 3 different answers or ranges of answers for the Hubble constant.
Yeah.
And there are at least two main methods of determining it. And they're not coming up with the same answers. And this happens again and again in science when you have different methods. You have assumptions. And your assumptions will, if you can prove your assumption, that will mean that this other team's assumptions are wrong. Okay?
It's called science.
You just
keep working at it, and other people will develop methods. And eventually,
if you get other methods,
then eventually you'll come up with an answer.
There was a famous case in evolutionary science.
The question is, what's the point of a scientific debate? Yes, it is. It would be, in theory, useful to know that the idea is to keep open and come to an agreement as to how much the data is telling us and so forth, and then leaving it at that, and hopefully then the experimentalists or the observers can come back with more data. The point, though, I think of a reasonable debate, sort of in the sense of a college debate or perhaps a trial, which of course involves rules of evidence and certain rules of procedure, is it forces each side to lay all their cards on the table.
Yeah.
And so you can see exactly what each side has.
Yeah.
So as long as it's done in that spirit and not taken personally or anything, then it's quite useful.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it depends what you mean by a debate here. Yeah.
Well, that's what's wrong. And now you're making me realize what's wrong with Nemiroff's quote, where he's saying the two sides in this by binary setup, the two sides know that some of their foundation is squishy, but they are forced to make a firm statement because that's required.
And I think that's problematic.
And it's problematic. And you're saying very interestingly, rather than I tuck my concerns under the table, I put them on and I rank my knowledge like the IPCC. I mean, I gradate it and then I'm not sure how that leads to a good answer.
I think one problem with being honest about all that stuff is that there are people who really don't believe in science at all and who think that scientists are just making up everything and lying. And anytime a scientist says, I'm not sure this evidence is quite right, and they will say, the world is flat after all because, he isn't sure about this data.
Yeah.
I agree with you, and I think that's where we have to make the distinction between intellectual exploration and policy.
Yes.
When you make policy, you're going to be making mistakes. You have to make this one or that. Are we going to have a ceasefire in Gaza or not?
Well, let's we have a question here in the
also a comment discussion. I think it also has to do with how the mind works, kind of. But also relating back to purpose, I guess, like goal. There you go, goal. The goal in the end is to seek answers. And how are we going to get those answers? And I guess you could call this great debate, as how he said, an exploratory debate. Because, like the foundations might be squishy, we're willing to replace them, try and get to a consensus and a final answer. And that's how we're going to do it, which in the end is more or less how science is made. Yeah. So, more or less.
So that was what I was trying to convey in this presentation, which was that the standard story ends with Hubble decisively answering this question about the nebulae being separate from our system and therefore and possibly similar to ours, but out there. And that was the answer that Shapley had supposedly refuted with his model. Okay. But then really, it's almost exactly what you've been explaining, which is there was another level to this, which is what is the scale of the universe in that case? This thing that's blowing apart, turns out. And then where are those galaxies and why are they different shapes and why aren't they all uniform and the other questions that follow from it? So one debate leads to another debate, sort of kind of thing. I don't know.
Okay. Do we have any other questions?
One more specific.
Please.
If anyone knows, is the Shapley cluster the great attractor?
No, they're not. And I thought you all would know the answer, so I wouldn't have to tell you.
I don't know it.
Okay. Well, from very brief, the Shapley is a supercluster because they discovered that many of the formations were even more concentrated. You're nodding, right? Okay. And the attractor thing is was attributed later, given his name, because of all the other things he had done in this exact arena. But it has to do with the mega forces that seem to be moving the different clusters around. And if you saw that, in fact, let's just end on a science note, if you'll bear with me. How do I go back? Oh, there's Elizabeth. She's going to help me. To me, the Shapley attractor graphic looks like it's a medical school thing, you know.
Yes, you should be able to flip through them now.
Oops, there we are. Whoops.
No.
And this is just a crop to fit into the space. The actual graphic is much bigger. And something's detracting a dipole repeller. There's a force of repulsion. What they're doing is they're mapping these movements among the different big elements here, including the Shapley cluster.
And I'm sure that with the data from the Webb telescope, those diagrams, at least the diagram of the attractor and all that stuff, that's probably going to be rethought, because they're looking way, way farther away than anybody can.
Well, Guy, if you or anybody in the group or listening finds web images that bear on this, please send them to me immediately. The web telescope people are very friendly to this project, but there's so much imagery and there were so many objects that Shapley's associated with that it's what would be really useful to put out there. I think this was helpful in that I'm going to get in touch with Margaret Geller about the wall, and since she's a Harvard person, Margaret actually remembers some point seeing the original maps, which have been lost apparently. But, you know, they were very big.
That's your sister, your mother, or your cousin?
Margaret Geller is a famous Harvard astronomer.
Okay.
We're not related to everybody. Be nice. But, well, thank you very much, everybody. I've enjoyed it, and I appreciate you.
Okay, I'm going to make one final announcement. As a reminder, the January meeting is going to be virtual only. It'll be on Zoom. Apparently, the glitch tonight with people needing to have a passcode to get in was because a blank had gotten introduced into the URL. So for future reference, always double check the long URL and make sure that if it wraps around to another line, that there's not an extra space in it.
Ooh.
Okay. So be very careful when copying and pasting these Zoom links and such. So it'll be virtual only. I will be running it, but there's nothing here. So do not come in person here. I will not be here. Zoom only next month. Then February, we'll be back to hybrid. Okay. Anything else?
Are we going to be observing outside?
I'd really rather not, because I've got an 8:30 flight.
You're the boss.
And I'm by myself, and I have nothing set up.
Yeah. All right.
So I have to shut this down and then get over there.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Who was talking on the virtual thing on January? Who is the speaker in January, and what is the subject?
John, do you have that? You're muted.
Oh, I got this one.
It'll take me a moment to get to it.
Definitely had a very simple writing style. And this is
on the calendar. So I've got that book.
Over and over again. So there were like six editions. And the point is that in the old days, this was how a family.
January 13th, I can't say the name. Shubham Kanodia.
There's a chapter.
Yes.
Giant exoplanets around low mass stars.
Yes. Okay. Good.
Thank you, Elizabeth.
And they were
thanks to Jeff. All right. Anything else?
I have it someplace in my stuff. It's why I have all the books and articles, which are huge. It's very productive. But this is just an example.
Okay, then we're going to be ending the meeting. I'm trying to.
Popular author and the book of the month. Where? Said, oh, good.
What happened to us now?
What's happened here? TikTok. What's that?
Hey, yeah, really,
nice
really
to see you. Thank you.
I
for
really
coming.
Like your article.
Thank you.
I think maybe you should send it up to astronomy.
Thank you for coming.
Why?
All right, yes, stop it.